lot of Pon's tinker poured out in return. "Hello, boss." Paul slid into his own chair across the ladderway from Joanna and started strapping in before lowering the chair to its full reclining position. Boss, he asked Tinker over his shoulder. "Are you stuttering?" Tink had always called Paul the boss, since he worked in Paul's space operations division. "Well, now you're my new boss's boss, aren't you?" Tink countered. "That makes you boss. "Boss squared," said one of the other technicians from a back row. "Running dog capitalist expropriator of the workers," came another voice. Paul knew whose without having to turn around. Alex Vodyohovich, tractor teleoperator and technician, on his way to a 3-month tour of duty on the moon. Paul jabbed a finger toward Joanna. "Here's the real boss," he said, then wondered how humorous the remark really was. Joanna cocked an eyebrow at him, barely smiled. Once he was settled in the seat next to her, Joanna leaned across the aisle separating them to ask in a whisper, "Who are those people?" "Our employees," Paul whispered back. "Some of the best people in the world. In the whole Earth-Moon system, as a matter of fact."
"And that one who called you a running dog. Why do you let him speak to you like that?"
"Wojo?" Paul laughed. "Wojo's the most creative cusser I've ever met. I've known him more than 6 years now, and I've never heard him resort to profanity or repeat himself. But he sure can burn your ears off." "Lift off in 2 minutes," came a voice from the cockpit over the intercom speakers. Paul knew that the astronaut, pilot, and co-pilot were in the cockpit strictly as redundancies. The Clipper ship was pre-programmed and monitored from the ground, just as it would be if it were carrying all freight and no people at all. Only if something went disastrously wrong would the human crew have anything to do. And then, Paul thought, it would probably be too late. But the government agencies had insisted on a human crew when human passengers were going aloft. "Takes 2 paying seats out of our cash flow," Paul fumed whenever he thought about the outmoded regulation. Then one of the astronauts came clambering down the ladder to check that all the passengers were properly strapped in and had cranked their seats back to the full reclining position for takeoff. He said a brief hello to Paul, smiled at Joanna, and then climbed back up into the cockpit and closed the hatch above Paul's head. Paul glanced across the narrow aisle and saw that Joanna looked pale. She's never been in space before, he knew. He reached out his hand and touched her shoulder. She clasped his hand in hers. Her palm felt cold, clammy. Grinning at her, Paul whispered, "You'll love it." She nodded, but looked extremely dubious. Lana Goodman. She was the first person to suffer a heart attack on the moon. Dr. Lana Goodman was a tiny wisp of a woman, a brilliant 52-year-old with degrees in medicine, physiology, and biophysics. She was rumored to be on track for a Nobel and could have had her pick of any university in the world. Indeed, she was teaching and conducting research in low-gravity physiology at Johns Hopkins when she applied for a position with Masterson Aerospace. "I want to go to the moon," she told the corporation's astonished personnel director. "I've always wanted to go there. I've had experience aboard space stations, but I haven't gotten to the moon yet, and I want to do it before I get too old." Masterson took her on as a consultant, making maximum public relations mileage out of it, and sent her on a well-publicized tour of duty at Moonbase. Dr. Goodman was expected to look after the medical needs of the 28 men and women who happened to be working at Moonbase at the time, as well as continue her own research on how the human body adapts to low gravity. Her heart attack was totally unexpected, caused by a clot that lodged in one of the smaller coronary arteries. She was eating breakfast when she felt a terrific pain in her chest, vomited up everything in her stomach, and half collapsed on the galley table. Her skin turned gray and sweaty. Since she was Moonbase's resident doctor at the time, she was attended by 2 of the base's paramedics, both of them engineers with other duties, who stood by for medical emergencies. They slapped an oxygen mask over her nose. One of them shot a load of clot-busting tissue plasminogen activator into her arm, while the other pushed aspirin and nitroglycerin tablets through her pain-clenched teeth. The paramedics contacted Masterson's medical staff in Savannah, who plugged them into the finest cardiac centers in Boston, Houston, and even Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. Within hours, Dr. Goodman was out of danger, thanks mainly to the clot-dissolving properties of the TPA. Within 3 days, she could walk around almost normally in the gentle gravity of the moon. But she could not return to Earth. Part of the problem was the acceleration of the rocket boost from the lunar surface, she knew, although that was only a minor part of it, since the liftoff was much less stressful than a takeoff from Earth would have been. There were G-stresses in re-entering Earth's atmosphere, too. They were greater, but she felt confident that she could handle them. The real problem was the condition of her heart, weakened by weeks of living in low gravity and now damaged by the infarction. She feared that she would be a cardiac cripple on Earth with its high gravity. After days of consulting with her Earthbound medical colleagues, Goodman decided she would have to stay on the moon for weeks, perhaps months, while slowly building up her cardiac strength through exercises specially designed to strengthen her heart muscle. She wanted to resume her medical duties, but the corporation had sent up a strapping young MD to replace her as medical officer and to watch over her while she recuperated. Looking more like a football hero than a physician, the young man supervised her exercise regimen with ruthless tenderness. Dr. Goodman continued her research, but this was not enough to fill her increasingly boring days in the cramped underground warrens of Moonbase. She had brought her camera with her, though, and started taking photographs. Not of the busy, harried, sweaty people who lived cheek by jowl in Moonbase. She got into a spacesuit and went out on the surface to take photos of the grandeur of the moon itself. She had no intention of showing her work to anyone but her fellow Moonbase residents. But one of them electronically relayed back to Savannah a few choice shots of the sun rising over Alphonsus's Ringwall Mountains. A minor executive in the public relations department showed them to an editor of a photography magazine. Within a month, several other magazines were asking for her work. She had started with ordinary color film, but soon asked her newfound friends in the world of photography to send her black and white film instead. It seemed made to order for the black and gray world of the moon. With dizzying suddenness, Lana Goodman became an artist of global renown. Her photos of the moon showed all the barren splendor of this new world in its rugged challenge. Her work adorned the covers of news magazines. Media personalities clamored to interview her live from the moon. The handsome young football hero of a physician left after his 3-month tour ended. The next doctor was a woman, just as qualified, just as determined to see that Goodman continued her exercise routine, but nowhere near as emotionally interesting. When medical tests showed she was physically able to return to Earth, she asked for a postponement. "I'm not ready," she said. "Psychologically, I'm not prepared to face the return trip." On the first anniversary of her heart attack, she decided to quit the subterfuge and ask her contacts in the corporation's personnel office to allow her to stay on the moon indefinitely. The decision went all the way up to Paul Stavanger, head of Masterson Space Division. In full sympathy with her desire and prodded by the corporate public relations director, he decided to allow Lana Goodman to stay at Moonbase as long as she wished. She never returned to Earth. Lana Goodman became the first person to live on the moon permanently. Space Station. The clipper ship took off with a thundering roar that was only slightly muted by the passenger cabin's acoustical insulation. The ship rattled hard enough to blur Paul's vision for a moment. Pressed flat against the reclined seat, he turned his head to see how Joanna was taking it. Her eyes were squeezed shut, hands clutching the armrests with whitened knuckles. The vibration eased off a good deal, but the bellowing thunder of the rocket engines still shook his innards. Then a sharp bang, and the noise abruptly ceased. Paul felt all sensation of weight disappear. One instant he was flattened against the chair, weighing 3 times normal. The next he was floating lightly against the restraining seat harness. Joanna's arms had lifted off her seat's rests. Her gray-green eyes were wide open now, looking startled. Paul grinned at her. "We're coasting now. 0G." She smiled back at him weakly. Within 15 minutes, the clipper ship made its rendezvous with the space station. The ship lurched slightly once, twice, a third time. Then the co-pilot opened the cockpit hatch and announced, "We're docked. They're attacking."